FBI, Sabine Foundations. They're going to tell us about how to make photos with Stokonian field theory.
Yeah. So, first question, do I need to introduce hardware theory, the grow drone theory here, or everybody's comfortable with that, what it's about? So, we could make a sketch first. Is that a yes or no? I should make a sketch. All right. So, so the question is, can we have some deterministic theory of producing a statistics of quantum theory? So, usually quantum theory, we have a state vector, we have a Riemann equation, like this. So basically what you're doing in the Borg-Drogon theory is just to first express things in the configuration space. So now I'm going to assume that we have polar particles. So the configuration space is the point of all particles, is the point of all particle configurations. So as an example, we might have a Hamiltonian that looks like this. And X collectively stands for particle 1, particle 2, particle 3, particle n, like this. So pilot wave theory is just one can do it like this, that you take just the quantum mechanical density to psi squared. Then you look for a continuity equation for this guy. And you know that this quantum satisfies a continuity equation that looks like this. And this is a vector as well. And this thing is just a probability character. So Ji is just equal to gradient of I think it's my 2mi. So if you have a probability current, you may of course introduce a velocity field like this by just taking the probability current and dividing by this one, psi squared. But of course this generates flow and configuration space. And a very simple way to introduce some deterministic dynamics is just taking particles that follow this flow and configuration space. Now this flow has particular properties. One property is that if you begin with an ensemble of particles following this flow with distribution rho equals psi squared at some time p0, then it follows from this flow that it will have rho equals psi squared at all times. One may wonder why so one could postulate this and arrive at you always have this nice quantum equilibrium distribution. But in fact, this may be relaxed. So, for example, here's the numerical simulation. You can, we have any quantum here? This is a different distribution. So, here's a quantum mechanical distribution that goes to some wave function. Configuration space. Here's a two-dimensional box. And we begin from a different one here. Then when you evolve according to this velocity field, you see that these two distributions coinciding with all modes. In this system, there's a recurrence of the wave function from here to here. They are identical. But the probability distribution calculated in this way does not coincide. So, in fact, you may take something different in tonight, and after a while, you will get this effect, rho psi squared, in both time directions. So, and this is very similar to how you do it in statistical physics. So, if you can account for statistics of the particle positions, then of course you reproduce quantum field, because in the end everything reduces to positions of things. We have outcomes in experiments with, for example, some measurement needle of some current pointing this direction or that direction. And this theory treats everything on the same basis, measurement apparatus, systems, and so on. So if I can account for part positions of the measurement of our scale here, I'm fine. And this fine reproduced quantum field. So this is a very, very quick sketch of final plane theories. So, this is sort of, it's not very difficult. It's too fast.
The only small thing, Hans, is that you used rho initially, it was defined as psi squared, and then later you're using rho to mean an arbitrary distribution, and then some people might get confused by it. Use different symbols.
You mean this guy here?
Well, up there you wrote rho equals psi squared?
Yeah.
So it makes rho look as if you're defining rho to be psi squared.
Yeah,
which you are then, really.
Yes, so the thing is here, you want to define the dynamics, the velocity flow, so you sure will reproduce quantum theory. So then you start with such an assumption here. It's not an assumption, but you start with this in order to generate the velocity flow, so you get these properties. That's how we can look at it.
Sure, but the point is rho there is defined as it's just a symbol for psi squared, whereas your rho here is a distribution of particles. It could be whatever.
Yeah, so.
So maybe it's just best to use different symbols.
So this is the reason. If you want to have the growth in size, but if you want to have the singularity property, you can start studying the continuity equation of this object. Then, of course, you get the velocity configuration space, which have nice properties. This is sort of the way one can think about that. Okay, so this theory has been done for non-atomistic theories. So now we're going to present some of Yes. So now we're going to present how you know this for quantum-related dynamics. So
it's one question. So you put the particle with that distribution, Then how do you evolve it? You just freely evolve it under the Hamiltonian or the quantum distribution, the classical quantum distribution, what do you do that?
This one.
So you use that,
exactly.
And you evolve it.
Exactly. So each particle moves according to this. So okay. then of course you may evolve the probability distribution as well.
But that is so the surprise is you say that, so once you start with that, pick one row at one time and put particles, then use that VA to evolve it. Then you will see that the row, the distribution is always the same as predicted by the equation. The distribution is predicted by starting the equation. Is that what you said? What you said there?
So this is something in addition to the Schrodinger equation. This is an additional thing, an additional equation. It's not the Schrodinger equation or anything like that. It's a guidance equation for particles. For actual particles to have both position and definite velocity. The velocity is given by that. And at each time they have a well-defined position as well. Then of course we consider an ensemble of such parts with some probability distribution. You may evolve this probability distribution.
The VA comes from
psi, yes.
Psi, right?
So psi is the guiding field in this theory. Psi guides particles. It's pretty much like water waves, if you want to classify another analogy. You have water waves and they put the cork. And the cork will go in the direction orthogonal to the equi height, so the flat is the same thing, in fact. Right, this can be written in this way, where this is the base of the wave function. So this is analogous. So, of course, when you realize that you don't have to have rowing for size gradients, you can get into questions of what happens when you don't have rowing for size gradients. And that's, I think, the interesting thing about this theory, that in those cases it has different predictions than quantum theory. And it's important to see to what extent we can drive series and so on in the nature. So, but here the goal is less than that. We won't look for new experimental prediction. We'll just sketch how you can do it for quantum electrodynamics, how you would develop such a theory. So, first of all, to have fields in the quantum theory is not new. It was done already by Bohm in 1992. So basically, you have a configuration space of field configurations. And then the definite field configuration is guided by wave function. So this approach can also be extended to scale of field masses, field one fields, and so on, and to the fields of the standard model. There's no problem. But there's no working formulation for fermions. And this is what is new here. We will show how you can do this, at least in one way. There's been two attempts, one by Holland, 1998, I did, to develop the quantum wave theory for fermions, and also one by Elton here in 1992. So in Valentini's model, there's a problem with the probability density. It doesn't really exist. And then, of course, we have a problem to reproduce the statistics of quantum theory, because we really need some kind of probability coming in from somewhere. Holland's model has a similar problem. It doesn't have something called effective collapse. And that's essential in the quantum wave model in order to reproduce statistics of quantum theory. We're going to be a little bit more detailed about this, what this effective collapse is. We're going to be detailed about how our model actually had an effective collapse. So these X's here, these are called variables. This is an action configuration being guided around. This is something in addition to the wave function, something we can say really exists out there. So this thing here we can describe by these X's, this part position of this cat, it will have nothing to do with wave function. So when you do quantum wave theory, you talk about variables, and variables are this extra thing which is supposed to exist independently of where you do observations of these things. We're going to say something rather drastic here, that you don't need to introduce variables for fermionic degrees of freedom. That may sound drastic, that we don't grant existence to, for example, particles or fermionic matter in this path. That seems crazy, and we're going to show how we can come around it. So our proposal is very similar to John Bell's model for spin. There has a variable, that is a parking position, for the electron, but there's no variable, something really existing, connected to the spin variable. Spin is just a property of a wave function, and the wave function is that which guides the particle, which only have position but no spin in this theory. Similar in our theory, we have only variables for the bosonic degrees of freedom and not for the fermions. The fermions will just be a property of the wave function, will make a multi-component. And the bosons will be guided by this multi-component wave function. And why is this fine to do this? Well, first of all fermionic fields are gauge coupled with bosonic fields. You will never find a fermionic field without the corresponding bosonic field. And this is the gauge principle. So you can say that these bosonic fields will always tell about the fermions somehow. And number two, why can we do it? Because we can reproduce the quantum statistics of QED, at least. So this is the main reason why we, it would be justified. So I'm going to go through first the general framework of this theory. The way in which we do not associate variables, for example, to spins or to fermions, not to bosons, how we deal with it mathematically. So this is a general framework in which Bell's model for spin falls into, and also our model. I'm going to explain effective collapse with John Bell's spin model. Maybe it's enough if you do it with, so we can see about the time how it is. Then Warren's going to take over and review Bohm's 1952 model for the electron field. So after that is done, it's very simple to just go to our model through this simple step, in fact. And then we're going to present, or Warren's going to present the model for electron dynamics. So this is the general framework. Suppose we have two Hilbert spaces, H1 and H2, and they are spanned by some bases here. It's very inconvenient to look in here, because I need to look at the book. So they are spanned by some bases, O1 and O2, in these two Hilbert spaces. Now we consider the product space. Then, of course, we can consider the product basis as well. And, of course, any state might be written in such a form there. Density matrix is like this. And in components, it will look like that. So this is very simple. Now I'm going to do the trick of associating, starting the process of associating variable states only to one degree of freedom and not the other. We want to associate variable states to degree of freedom O1 but not O2. So this is simply what we do. We trace out over the degree of freedom O2. We get the density matrix, O1 and a reduced density matrix. In the end, we could have a reduced density matrix in components, and then we look at the diagonal components. And this we may interpret as a probability density for these variables O1. Now, given this O1, we can, as before, just start with the continuity equation. We just plug this into the Schrödinger equation and look what would be the conserved probability current there. As soon as we get that, we just divide the probability density and we get flow on this configuration space. And this is the general scheme. So this has been considered also by Holland and Squires and Roche and similar things.
Why is the bug, disappear in the equilibrium channel? Which disappears? Why is it Holland bug?
O1 bar
is a common
So O1 bar is just, you need two components. I mean, you have a matrix on this side and that side. So this is, it's the same as you write density matrix. This is anything, yeah. So we could have write O1 prime there. But then, of course, you want the density of density like that, you just consider the diagonal component, which is what we're doing. So, that's model for spin one half bar. You have two Hilbert spaces, you have position Hilbert space, which is spanned by position eigenstates. You have the spin Hilbert space, which you see too here. These are the basis of this states here. Then, of course, the product basis would be something like this. And you can write any state in terms of these product basis. Now we want to not associate variables to the degree, the swing degree of freedom, but only the position. So then we do exactly before. We consider the density matrix. Then we trace out. It's done here. We trace out over this degree of freedom, this mean degree of freedom. Then we may look at the diagonal components. We may look at the continuity equation. In order to do that, we need the Schrödinger equation. And if you look at this, you're going to see that this is the probability current you arrive at. And then to define the dynamics of this system is very simple. It's just dividing by rho of psi squared here, get the x to t. And this is just Bell's model. Should I go through this? Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not. Let's see how effective collapse works for this theory. Suppose you have a wave function, psi a here, and it has split up into the superposition of psi 1a and psi 2a. Then, if this is zero, psi 1 times psi 2 for all a and all a prime, for all x, we say that there are no overlaps. So this is just the definition. Then we have nice properties following from that. So if you want a picture of this, it's something like this, or this is rho 1, rho 2. Collapses when this happens. In fact, when rho 1 times rho 2 is equal to 0 for all x. In fact, if this is true, you can show that you arrive at this condition. You need this branching of the probability density. If this happens, and the vehicle, the point particle, happens to be here, you can show that neglect this because it's just guided by this part of the wave function. So, suppose the layer interfere in the future, but suppose that doesn't, then you may just take away this part here. This is effective collapse. It's something you can do for all practical purposes, but it's not needed, but you can do it because since it's here, it won't be affected by this part of the wave function.
Yes, under what conditions will say we combine? Is there a thermodynamic argument in back of that, or just curious?
There is no, I mean, that's a really messy thing.
Okay.
So basically, we know that it's extremely hard to do that in practice. So, but of course, we might. So now we just discuss one particle, so that's probably easy to do. But when you have many, many particles, that is very, very difficult. So I'll focus on one particle just to get this picture across. If you want to describe a multi-particle system, effective collapse is going to happen in the configuration space of all these particles. And it's going to be very, very hard to make this combined.
Yeah, and the point is you only need separate, in a many body system, you only need this non-overlap with respect to one degree of freedom. That's enough to separate and configure
that conditional.
So if you know, if these particles interact with the environment and so on, in order to get re-interference, you'd need overlap with respect to every single degree of freedom involved. Which, I mean, this is what Bohmann in the 1952, which then, you know, one can say, well, that's sort of unlikely. No one's really, to my knowledge, looked at it more deeply, but certainly seems to fall.
And if they happen to be overlapped, then of course quantum theory would also make predictions of interference, which you would get in this theory. So, of course, it's the same. You say in quantum theory, now I can collapse a wave function because I made a measurement. But maybe you were not allowed to collapse a wave function because some funny guy comes and does some funny physical operation with a very, very contrived abdomen. That may happen there as well. You never know. But that's very, very, very unlikely. So when affected collapse occurs, this is the important part, that the particle, one particle is either guided by one or the other. Then you ask, what is the probability then for the point particle to enter this branch or that branch? Well, that is just going to be given by this part here. And that's how you explain quantum statistics. Yeah, let's re-simplicate that. So, for example, in Holland's model, it's impossible to find wave functionals that have this structure. They all look like this. They all overlap significantly. And then you cannot say, what's the probability of entering that branch? Wow, they're overlapping and so on. You can't really get first quantum outcomes. Secondly, some statistics concerning those outcomes.
Is that because these degrees of freedom are sort of cyclic angular variables?
So this is the general reason why. He deals with a very, very big liquid space, and then he confines himself to a very, very small part of that liquid space. And then his variables, which are defined with respect to this big liquid space, he also writes down wave functions according to this cyclical dimension. So he has a big limit space which stands by eigenvectors of all his angles. Then he's restricting his states to the spin hat, for example, in his spin model and in the rotor model as well. Like this. So it makes a restriction on the state to be like that. Is that correct? No?
That's for your normal physics in Hall.
Yeah, this is normal physics in Hall. And this is a restriction. So you have big input spaces spanned by these variables. And you expect yourself to find a big field. And then you're going to find that this is too small to have normal lab wave functions. I mean, in the big space, there certainly are. But not in this, you cannot find them here. And that's, I would say, the most general reason why it fails to have effective collapse. Exactly the same thing applies to this rotor model for fermions. In fact, they're very, very similar to these models. So, also in that case, it means from a big Hilbert space, when you have Euler angles for all positions. And then for each position, he does something similar like this. And so again, he restricts himself to a very, very small part of the Hilbert space.
So then, if I can add something, according to me, it's just a mere accident that all these physical states have significant over restriction of the Hilbert space he's seen. You have this big Hilbert space, but then all the states are physical. And if you restrict yourself to these physical states, you see that all states are a significant overlap. But according to me, it could equally well have been that these states were non-overlap.
That's what he's saying, that maybe this is not the most general reason why that happens.
So they just happen to be non-overlap. Yeah. That's it. There's no real reason for it.
What you seem to say now is that you're not ruling out the possibility of an underlying
fermion.
Just the particular proposal to make it doesn't seem to work.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So,
Did he suggest that how the proposal for the spin degree of freedom also has this problem?
Yeah.
So you're saying that not only is the fermionic problem, but his model for spin both suffer from the problem that they have affected class?
So let me explain more carefully. The individuals are these ones. X, these are his individuals in his case. Okay, so X and the variables. You don't have a non-overlapping space in this part, but you still have it in the X part.
So he has some extra variables which would never select branches and so on. It makes states non overlapping. So in a sense these are not very useful. You say what Bell did was to try to recognize this in a statements way, just work with X, because there that's the minimal thing you can do, just work with X, and then you have non overlapping states. You can introduce this and you get when defining the variable theory and so on. What happens in fermionic field theory is that you have your bosons, very sketchy, you have your fermionic degrees of freedom. And in Holland's model, this he didn't do it with both bosons and fermions. But if he would have done that, he would have found that he could equally have a finite wave model without those fields. This is in fact what we're doing. Because he's still not doing good, the whole counting selecting branches. But I'm not sure if he could do that. Maybe he could develop such a theory, and then it would be a finite variable theory. But it's the bosonic degrees of freedom that are fundamental here. The other one, making sure it branching and effective collapse, and making sure that you reproduce quantum statistics. And actually get the quantum outcomes. It's not even fermionic degrees of freedom.
So how is the model of fermions? It was a model of just fermions and photons?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So
presumably maybe then had he tried to find a model of just spin that in position degree of freedom, you might have found a similar effect that in a model that just has spins,
exactly.
You don't have effect.
Exactly. So that was doing a minimum model of spin. We don't introduce the vehicles for these degrees of freedom. We're doing the same thing here. We're having a minimum model, just as a long associated vehicles to these things. So just one final remark before I work with Robert. It's already half an hour now. So this concerns positions. If I can account for positions of things, I'm sure that I will account for quantum statistics. So what I'm saying to you now is that I won't have fermions. Nothing in space will be part of positions or fields or fermions or anything like that. So how, what is a camp then? That's the most basic question. Well, in our theory, this camp is just a region in space where electromagnetic fields behave differently. And you're going to see that we can account for positions of things in our theory, because if you analyze the light in this region here, you will see that in this region here, you can infer that this red light coming from this direction here, and so on, blue light in a little bit different direction. And if you can't work there, you wouldn't see that kind of light, a different kind of light from the blackboard instead. So in the electromagnetic field, it's encoded the positions of things. In particular, now, computer outputs and so on, when you get a particular experiment or whatever. These are encoding the electric field. So it's not as radical as you might see from the very beginning, because everything, positions of things are still there. It's just that one has to rethink a little bit about what it can be.
Well, actually, before you get into that, the K could be a boson as a composite object, right?
Yeah, there's lots of bosons.
Does it that become a vehicle in this theory?
Which one?
The K, or a hydrogen atom?
No,
it doesn't become, doesn't it?
There's only a radiation. What's the problem of quantum electrodynamics? There's only a radiation theory. It's only radiation.
Okay.
Nothing else. Of course, it's a different matter. You can develop this for QCD if you like. Then, of course, around quarks, it's probably going to be some gluon field because of, I don't know, confinement inducing. I don't know. So that might be. So, of course, there will be a lot of gluons around here as well. It's bosonic inducing field. But that's not, it's not that important. The important thing is that everything you need to know about the macroscopic world is in the electromagnetic field.
But in the radiated modes of the electromagnetic field.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you had
this is the electromagnetic field.
Okay. What happens to that?
To the back?
Well, I mean, you said you have it on the height and then the ground state. You have, what's the description of that?
So, as usual, you have, so now we're in fact going into a room towards,
well, okay, you can wait.
So this is a transversal,
Wow, so maybe you have a room for a fraction?
Well, I guess, I mean, the hydrogen atom is a thing, but there's no radiation if the thing is sitting in its ground state.
No. So, a hydrogen atom in the moment has a property of the wave function, has a particular state of the wave function. That wave function regards life in a certain way. So, if you make an experiment with a hydrogen atom, which is not something of a property of the electron field, of course, the vehicle, the electronic field is going to behave differently if you have a state in which you have hydrogen atom, or a state in which you don't have hydrogen atom. Or if the hydrogen atom is in the ground state, first excited state, second excited state, and so on. So in microcosmos, this theory is sort of much more strange. I mean, it doesn't have this picture of quantum particles out
there. But isn't there still, I mean, we haven't had any ground state, there's still an electromagnetic field.
Right. So there's one thing here. If you have a point charge here, you have longitudinal modes like this ground. You have an electromagnetic field which has a single variable there. But these are the longitudinal modes. And in fact, you cannot give the needles the longitudinal nodes, because they're intimately connected to the fermions. In fact, once you give a representation for the fermions, you give a representation for the longitudinal part of this gap. We only give people states to the radiation part, which is the transversal part. But this is your work, right? In fact, we're back.
We can better stop it from this time, and we will give it a question.
So,
is it better if you're wearing that thing, or are we just abandoning it?
I didn't, and I think of it. I thought it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
No, we don't have to take notes, we can just listen to what he's saying there and then.
So, already a lot of important things are said, so I'm just going to guide you through the model and then let you see how things work and why it is a good model. So, in our model for QED, quantum electrodynamics, the beams will be fields. And we will introduce fields and not particles. And we will introduce these field beams in a similar way as Bohm introduced them already in his seminal paper in 1952 for the field electromagnetic field. So what I will do is just first briefly recall how Bohm's model, spider wave model for field electromagnetic field works. And then it will only be a small step from Bohm's model to our model for QED. So Bohm started with the free electromagnetic field quantized in the Coulomb gauge, so for which the Hamiltonian is given by this expression. So this Hamiltonian only depends on the transversal degrees of freedom. A transversal degrees of freedom of attack potential and a transversal degrees of freedom of the momentum operator. So this is transversality condition. So these transversal field operators satisfy the following computation relations, which are compatible with transversality of the fields. So then, in order to simplify things, one goes over to Fourier modes by using the following Fourier decomposition, where you have some polarization vectors, epsilon. And these Qs are the field and momentum space now, and you have two of them. Q1 and Q2, and these represent the transversal degree of freedom of vector dimension. And you also have two corresponding momentum fields. Now the computation relations for these three buffers are just the standard canonical computation relations. So this is ordinary Compton series stuff, which can be found in many textbooks. So in order to go to Bohm's model, we need to use the functional Schrodinger representation. That's also still a conventional quantum series. So how is this functional Schrodinger picture introduced? Well, before I continue, let me just mention, we won't adopt the greatest possible mathematical rigor in presenting and using this functional Schrodinger picture. Because we're dealing with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, we'll have to deal with the appearance of infinities. Nevertheless, one can make this functional Schrodinger picture mathematically well defined just by applying suitable minimization techniques. And this is work done by Szymanczyk and Muschel. So we just give you the live version of functional Schrodinger picture. So this works as follows. We just choose as the basis of our Hilbert space the eigenstates of the field operators Q1 and Q2. So each element of this base is labeled by a pair of functions Q1 and Q2, which we assume to be smooth functions. Using this basis, the operators Q1 and Q2 become just diagonal, and the operators pi 2 are represented by functional derivatives with respect to the field Q. A quantum state is expanded as follows in this basis, with this psi, the expansion coefficients, and these psi's are wave functionals living in configuration space of fields Q1 and Q2. So we also have a Schrodinger equation for these expansion coefficients. So now one can very easily go to a Bohm model. So here we have a wave function living on configuration space of fields. So in the Bohm model, as Bohm originally introduced this model, we also introduced two Beagle fields, Q1 and Q2. So this is very simple, similar as a normal elliptic quantum theory, We have a wave function, we're not taking an argument x, and Bohm introduced the Beagle position. A part of the view represented by some position vector. Now we have a wave functional living in the great space of fields, and then we just introduce field fields, also represented by the symbol Q. So the velocity field for these field fields Q is just found by dividing the field current by the field density. And the field current is just found by considering continuity equation for the field density. So this object here is then identified as the field current. So this is Bohm's model for free electromagnetic field. So why is this a good model? Well, it reproduces the predictions of quantum theory. So how do we see that? Well, as Hans already showed you, it's essential to have effective collapse in our model. And should it have effective collapse, at least in following situations, when you have something like a measurement, or when you have evolution of your quantum state into a position of macroscopically distinct states. So here, of course, this is just a free electron field, so there's no point in discussing a measurement-like situation, because every needles and so fermions and stuff. So for the free electron field, it's sufficient to show that we have effective collapse when you have this evolution of the state into macroscopically distinct states. So first of all, this notion of effective collapse is similar but not the same as normal relativistic quantum theory. The only difference with normal relativistic quantum theory is that in normal relativistic quantum theory, the wave function was living in ordinary configuration space. Now, in field theory, these wave functions are living in the configuration space of fields. So, if you want to have effective collapse, our wave functions functions to develop non-overlapping branches, and it's going to raise stable fields. So, I made a comparison, a non-logistic quantum to wave functions corresponding to systems which are localized at different regions in space would be non-overlapping. Like means pointing like this or like that, wave corresponding wave functions would be non-overlapping. Here in the field is different. Fields, wave functions would be non-overlapping. Wave functions are non-overlapping if they're built around different field configurations. So, for example, one can show that if you consider only one photon in your state, then any two wave functions only containing one photon will have considerable overlap, even if these photons are localized in different regions in space. So, that's not a good example of non-overlapping wave functions. So, what are the non-overlapping wave functions here in the field case? Well, we can argue that microscopically distinct states will have wave functions which are non-overlapping.
And also coherent states are examples of these non-overlapping wave functions, which is a concrete example.
So yeah, if you want to have a concrete example, coherent states. Different coherent states, if we have sufficiently high photon numbers, will be non-overlapping. So for the three-dimensional field, we are guaranteed that if we have evolution of your quantum state into macroscopically distinct states, then we will have fact collapse, because these terms in your superposition will be non-overlapping. So this is the bonus model for the three-dimensional field. So one can do similar models, one can construct similar model for the other proton states present in the standard model. For example, for the weak interaction bosons, strong interaction bosons, Higgs field, one can also discuss spontaneous symmetry gradient. So Anthony Valentini has done a lot of work in this field. It's only for fermions that we cannot go with this field ontology. There exist models with particle ontology, but not nobody has come up with a model with a field ontology. So our proposal is just not to introduce variables for fermions at all, but just for bosons. So I'm just going to show you how it works in the case of QED. So we started from QED, again, quantizing the Coulomb gauge, for which Hamiltonian is a form. So here we have again this Hamiltonian for the free electromagnetic field, which we used a couple of minutes ago. The Hamiltonian for the free direct field, some interaction term, and the Coulomb potential. So the commutation relations for the electromagnetic field operators are unmodified compared to the free case. So we're going to use the same representation as in the free case for these field operators. So we also have some anti-commutation relations for the direct field operators. For the direct field operators, we won't choose a representation explicitly, because we're going to trace out of the fermionic release anyway. So again, this is just conventional quantum theory. There's nothing special to this. So this tracing out over the fermionic release field, how do we do it? Well, just like in the general scheme as Hans presented. We have a product hubble space here, bosonic hubble space times a fermionic hubble space. For a bosonic hubble space, we choose the basis as before, which is the eigenstates of these Q operators. For the fermionic hubble space, we just label, we won't choose the representation explicitly, and we just label the basis elements by label F. So one could choose, for example, Fock space, and this set of basis states would then just be the set of conventional basis.
The model is also independent of what basis we choose. It's not dependent on that, so that's why we do not need to specify.
Yeah, but it's all, it is dependent on what FOC representation you use. You could use different FOC representations, you could choose the graph representation, which would. which would yield you an inequivalent Bohr models, but these repetitions would already yield an equivalent quantum series. So that's not worried for us. So then we just consider this product basis for the Hilbert space, and the states are expanded as follows on this basis. Here, these wave functions now comparing from carrying an extra label F as compared to the free case, and this label F just representing the programming real field. So in order to get our model, we're just going to trace out of this programming real field. So we just do that as Hans explained. We consider the density matrix, which has the following expression for a pure state. And we just trace out over this fermionic real field. So by tracing out of this fermionic real field, we obtain this reduced density matrix. So then we can look at the diagonal elements of this reduced density matrix, which are given by this expression. And these diagonal elements, this row, represents density and can be interpreted as the density, the probability density of finding a quantum system in the field configuration P1 and P2, irrespective of what fermion degree the field is. So, how do we construct our Bohr model now? Well, we just introduce B roots P1 and P2, right, for which the density in an ensemble is given by this row. And the velocity for these beams is just found by dividing the field current, which can be found by considering the continuity equation for root. So the velocity is found by dividing the field current by the density. So that's the model. So now we have to explain why this is a good model, that this is the reduced quantum theory. Well, we claim it does.
What?
Yeah?
The vehicles and these cues, are those. They look like the four. The creation of what are they? What do they correspond to in the 12 theory? What are the cues?
So they in fact correspond to the transversal degree of freedom of the vector.
That's the Fourier transform there. Mm.
So if I go back.
Okay.
So I started with this Fourier transformation.
Oh, right.
So these eigenvalues of these operators you want to do somehow correspond to the views.
Okay, there's the plane waves of the vector potential. So yeah. There's only two vehicles for space time point?
Yeah.
In the whole theory.
For point in momentum space.
Is the electric field kind of a vehicle also?
So you could associate with these Q1 and Q2, you could associate transversal vector transfer.
It's just a different mathematical representation of the Q1, isn't it? It's just convenient for you to write it in terms of Fourier.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not worried about the Fourier decomposition. I'm worried about that. I'm just wondering that the picture was supposed to be that. That the electromagnetic field is real, the fermions are, they're the wave function. So, mm-hmm. So when I think of the electromagnetic field, I'm thinking radiation, I'm thinking two components of the E field and two components of the B field. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's what I have here, because the A field is usually the configuration space, and then the E is the conjugate momentum.
Yep.
So you might, I'm not sure if you're getting rid of the E just as you get rid of the E. In the particle law theory, or are you keeping E somehow?
No, we don't keep E, because E would indeed correspond to these momentum operators.
Right.
So Fabian stated the velocities of the B will somehow correspond to E.
Okay.
So as a velocity of, because the quantum theory has position, right? So it has a certain velocity and a certain momentum. So in that way, you could associate momentum through a vehicle with normal responsibility. In the same way, you could associate an E field through our vehicles in the field case.
Which would just be minus the time derivative
of it. Yeah, exactly. Minus the time derivative of the transverse part of the vector tension is giving the E field.
Okay.
that's only, so this E field is an only derived concept from your magnetic field, which is more closely related to B field. So here in the interacting case, how do we reproduce quantity? Well, we just have to show that we have effective collapse and measurement like saturations. So we have here this condition for effective collapse, which is very similar to spin. But it's most easy to explain with an explicit example. So Hans has already explained it to the can, light scattering over the can. You can think of any, well, most measurement situations go like this. For example, if you have a device measuring the spin of the needle, measuring the spin of an electron. So suppose this device contains needle, pointing either like this, if the result is up, or like that, if the result is down. So in all of this technology, this situation, in which you have a superposition of these needles, you would have effective collapse. So here we have to go a little bit further. You have to consider the light scattering of this needle and reaching around. So this light scattering out like this or like that, that will be macroscopically distinct. So because it's macroscopically distinct, so we can guarantee that we will have effective collapse. Okay?
It has to be distinct in the momentum space.
No.
So what you established earlier, that it has to be non-overlapping momentum space such that two single photon would be
so it's in configuration space that they have to be non-overlapping. And then of course you may describe your fields as Q of K or A transversal of X. But it doesn't matter. If you have wave functions centered around a point you call A transversal of X or Q of K, it doesn't matter, it's the same point.
This is Fourier transform.
Yeah.
But you're making a specific choice of whether your vehicle is at the position of the momenta. It seems to me you need to have the non-overlapping conditions satisfied for whichever variable you've chosen as your vehicle.
So
you should have a non-overlapping condition satisfied.
It's fundamental. It's both your vehicles.
Yeah. I mean,
the vehicle is a field which I can write in terms of its Fourier component or in terms of the real space values. It's
non-overlapping in configuration space. And configuration space has nothing to do with constant configuration space of fields, and has nothing to do with momentum space or position space. A point in this configuration space of fields, you might label by Q1 and Q2 of K, momentum space, or you might label it by A transversal of X. And that's the same point. So two states are non-overlapping. They will be non-overlapping no matter if you use Fourier representation or position representation, because they're just the same point.
Okay. Thanks.
So this is basically it. So the difference with our model that just non logistic quantity, the basic difference is, well, a non logistic quantity, people would say everything reduces to positions of things. Like Bell, for example, stressed that everything reduces to positions of things, like any patterns of a computer out there. So we're going one step further and say, okay, everything reduces to light coming from positions of things. Right? Light coming from some ink pattern or something is sufficient to have a working model. So this is basically it. So I can just resume what we've done. We've just constructed a pilot wave model for quantum electrodynamics. No deals for Fermion degrees of freedom of the wave function. Only deals for boson degrees of freedom of the wave function. In principle, one can extend this model, this pilot wave model, to the standard model of higher energy physics. So that's it. Thank you.
If you do not assign variables for the Fermion degrees of freedom, aren't we losing physics?
No. That's the fact of what is explained here with this effective collapse. You will reproduce the quantum statistics of quantum electrodynamics. And that's the short answer. Everything about microscopic positions and so on is encoded in the electromagnetic field. And this is a theory about everything, and that will include laboratory equipment and so on, and computer outputs and whatever.
So we need to think that this boson, this electromagnetic field disappearance are not physics, they're just out there, I mean, our imagination, but it's not physics. Physics is just going on.
Well, this is the crazy idea, yes.
It's the wave function.
Yeah. All the physics is still there. But it's fair to say that nothing in space, in our theory, corresponds to fermions.
Right,
so fermions is just a property of the wave function. There you have some fermion, but the wave function doesn't live in physical space. So in space, in our theory, it's only a radiation field. And that's enough. And that's what you would see also.
So your description is wave function is a non-entity. Just take a person in this room and just don't worry whether he exists there or not. Just you know it's interaction with the outer psychosis world, don't worry whether he exists or not. Something like that. I mean.
So the wave function in most theories is a little bit that's the downside of this theory, I would say. That's my personal opinion. Because it has to be granted, I think, some reality of its own. But then it lives in configuration space. So you see, this theory is about particle speeds or whatever in space. That's one arena. And then you have a different arena, which is configuration space, which the wave function lives in. It's sort of a strange picture of the world, but this is pretty much how it works. So one may have different opinions if this is good or bad. I find it a bit too nice.
Yeah, I never got this affecting collapse. Could you explain me that with any simple model? What do you mean?
The idea is basically this. Take ordinary quantum theory, the Schrödinger evolution, and collapse. That's a good theory for all practical purposes, you know how to apply it. You just don't know exactly when this collapse occurs. Right? Now we, in the pilot wave model, you can exactly tell when this collapse is going to emerge. Every time you have an effective collapse, it would somehow correspond to a collapse in ordinary quantum theory. So if you take quantum theory and you add these fields, and you can say, look here, at this point, this collapse will occur, which we call effective collapse, we have a good theory. Explain in short, that's the main idea.
It has to do with that you have a branching of the wave function, which happens generically in macroscopic situations. And then, since the wave function is zero in between, the beam will have zero probability of going from that part to that part. And since it cannot go there, you might just cancel it and take it away, and that's effective collapse in this theory. Then, of course, it might interfere in the future and so on, but that's very, very unlikely if many degrees of freedom are involved in the system. But it's very, very hard for anything to interfere again. And the probability for entering one of these branches is just given that by psi squared of this branch. So that's how we get quantum statistics.
So at one point you said that you weren't forced to make a different choice of physics. You didn't have to choose Fox for bosons or fermions. And so it sounds to me like you could not do that. In which case you could have a pilot wave theory for wave functions that weren't symmetrized for bosons and weren't anti-symmetrized for fermions. Would you get sensible field dynamics for those non-properly symmetrized wave functions? And could you then use that to argue in favor of requirements?
Are you saying opposing to doing some box space for bosons, which has not this?
So we're using field variables, and then there's no issue of symmetrizing anything, because symmetrization you do with respect to positions, degrees of freedom. If you write them in Fock space with a vacuum
So you're all the time, so are you in the flux space and you're just.
No, you're not using flux space.
No, you mean when they were tracing out over, you mean the fermionic flux space?
So I mean, this Pauli principle comes out as a triviality when you in field theory, because your operator has a certain structure, and whatever state you manage to create has to satisfy the Pauli principle, be it either anti-symmetric or not. And that's just the property of the operators.
But you are using flux space. You're just not necessarily choosing the eigenstates corresponding to well-defined numbers of excitations. So I was just confused because I thought we weren't actually restricting to the flux space, but you do, and then you have an arbitrariness in the choice of basis of flux space.
Well, we don't need to use flux space. Either. I mean, we could use Grassmann representation. It's not just Fox space. You can use it, anything you like.
And for bosons, what's the alternative to Fox space?
So,
you can have a basis with definite field configuration. So, having a basis. States with definite photon models. You can have a basis of states where, in this state, the electromagnetic field has a particular functional form.
But I can write that state in the same font space. It's just a particular coherent superposition of the number of eigenstates.
Is the field of configuration space unitarily equivalent to the
All the inequivalent flux space representations are contained in the field representation. Mm. So if you use flux representation, you can have unitarily inequivalent choices. If you use, in fact, field representations, you contain all these inequivalent flux representations are contained within the field representations. So for any state you can write down in a particular flux representation, there corresponds a wave function in field representation. So in my opinion, this field representation is therefore a little bit more neater than these flux representations.
A little bit more what?
Neater, nicer.
Nicer.
Because it contains them all. So. You have some uniqueness problems.
I had a question. I wondered if you had thought about supersymmetry. If you were going to try and look at a supersymmetric theory where you have symmetry transformations that mix up bosonic and fermionic degree to degree, could it be that intuitively it sounds as if you couldn't do something like this. If you wanted to do a Bohm version of a supersymmetric theory.
You could do it.
You could?
Yeah. So I just checked this simple example where you have a bosonic oscillator and you add a fermionic oscillator. And then you have just two component wave function, like in spin. Right?
Yeah.
So, and then you can still construct a Bohm model, just as you do for spin, because it's just a spin wave function, right?
Yeah.
But what you in fact do is not just tracing out over fermionic degree space. Because if you have the spinner, the upper part is representing the boson degree field, and the lower part is representing the fermionic degree field. So that if you construct your model, your Bohm model, as you did with spin, just trace out of these components. So in this supersymmetric model, this would mean that you keep, in fact, some degree of freedom of fermions and of the lowest.
Well, that's right.
But I'm not sure whether this property would still hold if you would consider realistic supersymmetric models.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
I mean, it might be a reason for saying that there should be no supersymmetry.
Or that it should be, because then you always have.
Well, there should be.
Then you always have fields of fermion state.
It'll go one way or the other.
No, because if you have supersymmetry, you mean have fields of fermion.
Is that the case?
I would guess so.
Or is it the opposite conclusion? I don't know.
Because in system engineering, you can really tell if you're increasing out of a fermion for one, because they're not separate entities. Yeah. Your wave function can be either represent your system in a boson state or in a fermion state.
Yeah. Interesting to see.
In non-logistic theory, you have good reason to take the position via vehicle rather than same momentum because of the possibility of things like the Coulomb's potential, which would give the hybrid theory that is somehow badly behaved. And if you just have a free bosonic field, the only exception is that if your potential is from a Fermat potential, then the position momentum are moving forward and you guide it to be. For a free bosonic field, that's exactly the situation you have this under determination. There's nothing that really forces you to choose an electric field versus a magnetic field, because in the free field it's just a Hermann-Gauss potential. And it seems to me at one point you suggested that there was a freedom in your choice of vehicle in this theory.
Well, I don't know. So in normal logistic quantity, if you go to a vehicle's momentum, the vehicles would be traveling in a momentum space.
Right.
So it would be somehow difficult to relate these vehicles traveling in a momentum space with vehicles in physical space, right? Or you should say that everything lives in momentum space.
More than that, everyone phone responded to Epstein's suggestion that they make momentum a vehicle, and he was saying that everyone exactly what the point was.
There's supposed to be some pathology where you have the Schrodinger equation in momentum space with a Coulomb potential. Then in momentum space, that Coulomb potential, instead of just being 1 over R and some
Of
operators in. So.
Do that just to define your Gauss equation? Just to construct it one more.
Is it okay if I just wrap this up and the people can stay as long as they want and carry on talking? I would just. So thanks for speaking to them. Carry on.
So here in the field case it's the same case. Now our fields can be seen as living in physical space, as in conversely vector tensors live in physical space. If you associate fields with the momentum operators, things could get more difficult.
If you can show that.
Sure thing. And another thing is just thinking you need effective collapse in there to, like if you use momentum a normal twisted quantity, you would use Beagle's momentum. For example, you won't have effective collapses if your needles are separated. For example, you have supposition of needles going like that. During the time they're growing, you will have effective collapses to them. When they stop growing,
well, it depends to some extent on the decoherence mechanism. If the decoherence is not merely sensitive to the position of objects, but also to their momentum, you could have effective collapses when the momentum. But the question I'm asking is, more, could it be that a choice of momentum is debatable actually leads to a pathological theory as it does in the non-logistic case for something like a Coulomb potential?
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be a question of empirical inadequacy, it would be a question of just pathology theory.
So pathology is just because you have this funny potential and it's okay. So here. So I don't see any my life pathologies because.
So
because.
Yeah, if you think
it's so it's only this interaction term you have, right?
Yeah.
In QD, so that would just be replaced by some drift pathology. So suppose you choose this other representation. Now I have this representation, after Q. It's represented by smooth field.
Yeah.
And corresponding momentum operator is represented by a functional gradient.
Mm-hmm.
So now we can do the reverse where we introduce vehicles for momentum. So does it mean that the operator Q goes to a functional gradient with respect to momentum?
Yes.
When it would only happen in the upper term, I think, but also here. There's no infinite series.
kind of a general question about the ontology. A word that this loses the appeal that the bone, the non-physical bone, did it at the first place. And that you can easily construct a case, or cases are generic, in which unless you're making an observation, there's nothing there. There's no matter, there's no particle. If you have a free electron, just moving along and accelerating in space. In this theory, or you have a wave function, there is no matter anywhere. Okay? Now, if you throw up some charged plate, you accelerate the electron, then you generate radiation, and all of a sudden, out of nothing, you got some radiation go on. So, there, you have the situation where making an observation, in some sense, generates the phenomenon, which is one of the things that. That was the kind of thing that people would develop the bone theory as an alternative. So I'm wondering what advantage we're left.
We don't need to refer to an observer.
There is no special process or other cooling inspection.
So there's no fundamental space for an observer or measuring device. You can explain it unambiguously.
But first, I should say it's a good point. I mean, yes. Yeah, you shoot an electron through a stone gala apparatus. There would be nothing like a field configuration moving either up or down. There would be something more, much more abstract, some fluctuations of the radiation field, and suddenly, boom, you will have some flash or scintillation screen over there. And you see no immediate reason why it would happen. In the non-electricity case, you say you saw the flash because there was a trajectory going on. Here, it would be less than that. It's only the macroscopic case when you actually have these nice pictures of things. This can is pushed in this direction because some other properties coming in and pushing it and so on. Uh-huh. And you have explanation things, but I touched vaguely on this point before, but I would say it's a good point. So, of course, we still don't have separation between system and apparatus, or server, and system, and all these things. But that's not the point you're raising. You're raising a point about appeal, I mean, how we can understand microcosmos. And I haven't investigated, but it seems like you're absolutely right. If you go to microcosmos, things are messy. Why do you get the point up there? It's because it's fluctuated in this way. That's why suddenly flashed over there. It was not something hitting it or anything like that. That seems to be, I'm not sure about this because I haven't worked things out, but it seems to me that this is the...
Right, in an empty room with a candidate, there is no, well, I mean, there are no candidates, right, in this theory. Well, there's no fermionic matter, so I mean, essentially, if you turn the light on, you can see the can, but all that's really happening in this theory is you have radiation bouncing where it comes in and comes out, but there is no actual can reflecting. Now, you have no radiation coming in and going out, then you have nothing. So if you're in a can in a dark room, there's nothing in the room.
So you still have boson fields holding the scan together?
Well, you don't want to allow the static fields, right? I mean, you're not...
No, so there are gluons around as well, but you don't get around.
Well, I don't know.
So let me make it more dramatic, your question. Okay. What happens if you do a measurement in a dark room where there's no light, selecting branches and so on?
Right, what do you even have in mind for what would be a measurement?
So I don't know how fine this example is, but I mean, you have examples of doing measurements in a dark room, and it's the squid with the 1 billion electrons going this way, superposed with other direction. What do you do there? You lower the temperatures so you don't have a radiation field at all. And then you do see these macroscopic superpositions and this resistance of getting collapsed. So I'm not sure if you can use this example to argue, yes, that you really do get this macroscopic situation. That's a good argument for our theory. I don't know about that, but I mean, this is just a comment about that.
Yeah. Another thing, is something a bit similar to what you're saying, just in the ordinary non-relativistic theory, when you measure momentum. I mean, when Bohm first showed how this theory works non-relativistically, I mean, a lot of people were surprised, well, you know, what is this? The particle, the momentum of the particle before the measurement was not equal to the sort of measured momentum from Bohm point out that there's this difference. So, I mean, in a way, this is just sort of taking it one step further and saying, well, you know, you're not just measuring the can that was there already, you're just analyzed the process of what you call a measurement. It's really a certain kind of experiment. Mm-hmm. And in this theory, we can give you an objective description of what is going on in this experiment. That objective description may not chime very well with what you intuitively thought was a measurement of something that really is, in a sense, is not really a measurement. But we've already seen that regarding...
You have to think of measurement as more active.
There's a certain kind of experiment in which various things interact and produce an outcome.
Can I make an example? Suppose we throw dice, and you want to understand why it was number 6 coming up. But in the end, you're going to find it was the property of the thermal fluctuations in the table because it's so sensitive. And it's sort of similar in this theory. The outcome where the flash would come on the simulation screen is very sensitive on all the small fluctuations in radiation. So it's sort of the same. I mean, in the case of the dice, to develop a deterministic theory in that case, it's not that important because you're not going to be able to use it so good, so well. It's going to be used almost the same thing here, I would say, in these situations. But in the microscopic limit, everything's going to start behaving more in a more regular way. That's I'm not sure if I was.
So for a given initial quantum state that's fixed, the only free parameter is the initial transverse vector potential. And it's differences in that that explains differences in outcome. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Can I ask you a sort of question, thinking about the experiments in the back room? Now, suppose we go take a room and we're just trying to understand how the thermal field actually interacts with the electromagnetic configuration field. You have this dark room, and it's got a very smooth floor, and I just stick my hand through the door, still leaving it very dark, with a snookerboard, and I roll the snookerboard across the floor. Is that snookerboard has direct field associated with it and charge field distribution, although it's electrically neutral associated with it. So as it rolls across the room in the grid, that's going to be changing the electromagnetic field configuration through the room as it moves through it, is it not?
Well, first of all, is it absolutely zero temperature? Just to make first one comment clear, in the dark room, mm-hmm. if you have a measurement apparatus there, it's going to have a thermal radiation. That's what's going to make fun. But now you can imagine that you cool things down to absolute zero, and then you roll this thing in there. And what would that correspond to in our theory?
Would anything happen to the electromagnetic field configuration in that room? Would it just sit there? Or would you see a movement in the electromagnetic field configuration?
Probably, yeah.
So in the dark room means that the initial vector potential is equal to zero, the field equal to zero.
Not really. I mean, a dark room means that you have a vacuum state, probably. Then.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right.
Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right.
Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. And would there be any difference in the behavior of the field being in this case? Yes, of course. But I'm not sure it could be something, well, probably not. It wouldn't be anything resembling an object. Maybe you could see something like that, but I'm not sure about it. Two reasons.
Okay, maybe you wouldn't have an object. The best you could hope to see is it looks like the imprint of an object moving along through the electromagnetic field.
Yeah. So maybe you could see something in the evolution of the field that there's some type. I don't know.
I mean, it might be worth mentioning, I said to you the other day, that, I mean, people around 1900, or late 19th century, were thinking that maybe the mass, you know, in classical electron theory, they were thinking that maybe the entire observed mass of the electron is purely electromagnetic. That the bare mass is actually zero, and, you know, the electrostatic self-energy is the complete mass, and there were Bill and Quanker and Lorentz, a lot of people were thinking that maybe everything, all matter could be explained purely in terms of electromagnetic field in some sense. I mean, it's not.
There's also this question of geomethodynamics was originally there for gravity.
And there's that too. I mean, Wheeler and his school had this idea that everything is just curved space with little.
And there's also Dirac's idea from 51 that you can use part of the gauge degrees of freedom of the vector potential to describe charged particles. So, and then he doesn't have any stuff because, I mean, like 0.4 or something like that. He just uses one part of the gauge degree of freedom, using the gauge degree of freedom in order to derive the charge density, the charge current. That's sort of similar.
So, I mean, basically, you're saying that. If I have what in quantum theory we usually think of as various physical degrees of freedom by combining different orbit spaces, then I can trace out part of it, and the bit that's left, I can say, well, I can assign variables just to this. So ultimately, you could have a theory, if I say I have a theory where there are pointers that interact with a whole bunch of other things. There's a Hilbert space for these various fields and particles, the Hilbert space for the pointer. I could have a theory in which I trace out everything and have variables just for the pointer. Right? You could do that. Or you could even have a theory where just the part of the Goldstein, because this basically what it's saying, you could even have a theory where, a sort of bone theory, where just the particles in your brain have variables. And strictly speaking, this logically it works. You can write down this theory, and it seems to. So it becomes a question: well, what is scientifically fruitful? What is
so Bell's model for spin is sort of accepted as a neat trick.
Yeah.
When you trace off, and then you go to the other extreme.
You go to the extreme, then
I need to run to the toilet.
I want to follow up on the question. But are there conditions that have to be satisfied for some degree of freedom for it to be possible to eliminate some degree of freedom? But like, if I have two particles, two motion degrees of freedom, can I really explain the statistics of experiments on them by tracing out one and only keeping the other? Wouldn't you get this problem that sometimes your field of degree of freedom would have overlapping wave functions?
Yes, probably would have.
So you have this stringent condition on when you eliminate degrees of freedom, which is what's left over, the wave functions have to become well separated in that yield space.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that just two pointers, would that be enough? Yeah, I guess. Maybe the pointers would become well separated.
I see. No,
pointers will probably not enough because sometimes you can realize the outcome of the experiment, yes or no. So there has to be something in the ring that registers this outcome.
So,
for this system in the ring, you would have no valid reflection. So, you could have a pointer in the ring, of course.
So why can't you absorb the brain into the wave function? I mean, that's the limiting point of this whole choosing, which is basically everything.
And in fact, you can even just be one brain, presumably.
Right,
trace out over all your brains.
But
you
can. Thank you.
So you only have all fermions are coupled to engage. So somehow if you keep track of the gauge fits, keep somehow track of the fermions. So because you have this gauge fits, we think we have kept specifically enough degree of freedom in order to assure effective fermions. because on the other hand, you could also trace out of the voltage. Some people do that, and so we can do that in experiments. And we go from Zangy, showing as a learning and having part of the deals and agreements, and we're doing this probability.
And also, what? At each time you may compute the expectation value of the charge, the density operator, you know, that will give you where the turbines are. That wasn't directly connected to you, saying about that. So what are you going to get with that?
You traced out over his brain, that's why.
Yeah.
Very nice.
The brain was absorbed in the wave.
Normal images, we